This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Yeah, I saw some guys I didn't know who they were in our conference room in suits, and I thought, oh, are we harboring the 1%? Is this like a safe zone that we've advertised?
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me welcoming our co-host, our man from Ohio, Terry Ryan.
Thank you, Mike. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Terry, it's great having you here. For our listeners, Terry runs our shop in Ohio. We talk often about school reform happening on the ground in the Buckeye State, and Terry is leading the charge. You know, had a lot of protests in Columbus this year around Senate Bill 5, collective bargaining. You seem to have brought the protesters with you to Washington.
Apparently, yes. They followed me here. It's pretty exciting. The protests, I must say, in Columbus were effective in that they scuttled Senate Bill 5 at the end of the day.
Well, at the end of the day, they didn't change the way the legislators voted, but they did get the public
excited. Yes, they did. Fired up.
You know, so we've got a big protest going on right now. Just outside the D.C. office of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, we're right near 16th and K, and that's where the Occupy movement is protesting today. I don't know. Are they marching on us? What's the situation here? Do we know? We've locked our doors, I think, just in case. We're going to send Checker Finn out there to mollify the protesters. You know, when he worked in the White House back in the Nixon days, he was, you know, part of the Kitty Corps, and they sent him and some of the other young people out to the college campuses to mollify them. And he has memories of going to Montana State University and other places to try to reason with the protesters.
Well, he was actually also at the State House during the protests when the governor gave his State of the State earlier this year. So he seems to be a magnet for this sort of thing.
That could be the situation. All right. Well, hey, lots to cover today. We're going to play Pardon the Gadfly. We're going to hear Amber's Research Minute. We're going to hear what's up with that. Daniela, get us started with the game of Pardon the Gadfly.
Great. Yesterday, Fordham and Public Impact released a report on charter incubators. Are charter incubators the key to bringing quality charters to scale?
First of all, Terry, what the heck is a charter incubator?
Well, a charter incubator is actually a strategic effort by a city to generate new high-quality charter schools. So it's not like just opening up the gates and saying, hey, come here and open charter schools. It's actually putting together a training program, putting together a fellowship, putting together the networks that successful schools need to be able to open not only one school, but multiple schools. And it focuses on school leaders. So they go out and they try to recruit the very best school leaders they can get. They give them the training and give them the support they need to be successful. So I think of it as a strategic approach to expanding high quality charters.
And I would guess that the answer to the question, is this key to bringing high quality charters to scale? The answer would be yes.
I would think part yes. It certainly is a strategy that I would encourage communities to pursue. I think there are many other things associated with this, though, like quality authorizing, things like how funding, facilities, all those sorts of issues. But this is certainly, I think, a promising reform and something that I hope a place like Dayton or Columbus or Cleveland, my home state of Ohio, will actually embrace.
And this is for kind of mom-and-pop schools or schools that have not yet been created. We're not talking about incubating KIPP to go, that's a different challenge. Oh,
this is kind of like taking the lesson of KIPP and applying it to a local setting. And it's saying, look, KIPP is not going to be able to, we've been trying to get KIPP to Ohio, have one super KIPP school, but they're not able to expand at the level that the demand requires. I mean, there are 420,000 kids waiting on waiting lists across this country for great schools. Right now, the five big CMOs, KIPP, Uncommon Schools, and the others, serve only about 60,000 kids. So the idea here is to take the lessons from KIPP and building excellent schools and great programs like that and saying, how are you going to do this in a place like Dayton or a place like Columbus? And so it's in effect in addition to what these big national CMOs do.
All right, great. All right, question number two, Daniela.
Checker draws an interesting parallel between the EU and the Common Core in this week's Gadfly editorial. Do you buy his argument?
Well, let's be clear here. We are still in favor of the Common Core, and you might think by having Checker compare it to the EU, that's not quite the same. Look, what he says in the Gadfly is we need to be rooting for the European Union to survive and for them to figure out a way to go forward and keep the euro on track. In the same way, we should be rooting for the Common Core to succeed, and that there's some parallels here. You know, the EU was trying to bring some commonality and a common currency across Europe, and this all started after World War II when these countries were very weak economically, politically, and here too in the Common Core, we're trying to help states go across state lines. Standards were very weak and low and fragile, and develop something that's greater than the sum of its parts.
And all of this raises some pretty thorny governance issues. At the end of the day, who's accountable for what? What's centralized? What's more out in the field or out in the country or out in the state? So getting all of this stuff is in sort of evolution as, mm-hmm. as we deal with a changing society and a more dynamic society. How do you ensure that there's quality governance and there's a balance here between central and local control and these things? And
right.
So I think he's on to an important sort of analogy.
Now, you know, opponents of Common Core will say, yes, this is exactly the problem, is that once you have these common standards, common tests, common cut scores, if you see uncommon results, which we're going to see, some states implement this well and others not, there's going to might be this call for more centralization. You know, just as in the EU, people say, well, we need to have empower Brussels to be even stronger. We have to, you know, keep the Greeces and Spains of the world from, you know, making promises to their citizens they can't afford and driving us all over the cliff. That's the same fear that's going to happen here. That there's a vacuum that that you're going to move inevitably towards greater centralization. And I think the key is how to do this in a smart way that keeps the sovereignty of the states. That makes sure that we have a very clear idea about what's a good thing to do nationally and what still makes sense to do at the state level and what we should do locally.
And the analogy falls apart a little bit because in Europe it's about money, and there and the lifeblood of a society and an economy is the finance system. And so you have huge disconnect in the finance system between a place like Germany and a place like Greece. I'm not sure that the you could say there's the same disconnect between a state like Massachusetts and Mississippi when it comes to standards. Certainly there's a huge sort of distance there, but now this is a fascinating mm-hmm. argument to have.
But as the people at KIPP say, knowledge is power and power is money, and I want some. Okay, topic number three.
As part of the 99%, Mike says.
Yes.
Topic number three. Sunday's New York Times featured an op-ed from a D.C.-based parent that cited school choice in the district as the reason for perpetuated inequality in schooling options. Is this true?
Well, no. This was such a frustrating op-ed to read. On the one hand, kudos to the New York Times for including a parent voice. This woman, I think her name was Natalie Hopkinson. But her argument was quite convoluted. Her complaint was that they are not good options in her own neighborhood in a part of D.C. that's mostly African-American families, middle-class African-American families, that many of the schools nearby were either closed by Michelle Rhee or consolidated. And many of her neighbors used to choose schools west of the park, Rock Creek Park, that used to be, you know, kind of this racial demarcation in D.C. But those schools now are filled to capacity. And so they don't have room for kids who are coming from outside the neighborhood zones. Well, that's not the fault of school choice. What's happening is actually more interesting. It's gentrification. Is that people that, you know, increasingly we have white families moving back to D.C., moving into these Tony neighborhoods, and what's new, sending their kids to the public schools, and not just elementary school, now in middle school and even high school. And the tough thing is that is pushing the out-of-boundary kids out, and that in practice means largely pushing the black kids out.
I think they need a charter incubator in D.C.
That's right. Well, that's the thing. So while this is happening, while those choices are going away, lots of new charter schools have come on the scene. Now we have 40% of the kids in the city in charter schools. And so the solution seems to be, hey, we need more good school options. Let's create more charter schools. Now, the parent rightfully says, look, it's not the same. It's not these charters aren't neighborhood schools. And you apply and you're in a lottery and you might not get in. And that breeds a sense of frustration.
Sure, but you could accelerate the growth of charters if you wanted, in part by making facilities available to high quality schools, yeah. And saying, hey, we support your growth, and having a strategic approach to yeah. how you fund them, making sure that they have access to facilities, making sure that there's sort of a common playing field here.
Yeah. But don't you think, Terry, I mean, I feel like one of the choices parents should get to have is the choice of a neighborhood school. I mean, if they want to have a neighbor, you know, if they like the idea of a school that's both close and a school where their neighbor's kids attend. So that should be one of the choices out there. I don't like the idea of moving away from having any neighborhood schools.
Well, and ideally, their neighborhood schools that are decent.
Yeah.
I mean, it's when they're not decent that you say, wow, we need choice. But there are also other parents who just want a different choice, a different structure, a different program, that sort of thing. But I'm with you on neighborhoods. My daughters go to a neighborhood school in Ohio.
Yeah. And so this is to blame school choice. And I guess, look, sometimes the argument is, look, if we didn't have school choice, then these neighbors would all band together and make sure the local public school
they would fix themselves. But we know from experience that didn't happen.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Daniela. Thank you, Terry. That's all the time we got for Pardon the Gadfly. This is fun, Terry. We should do this more often.
I enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.
All right, hey, you're still on. You're still on the hook. Don't you go quite so fast. Next up, we've got Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much.
Did I see you out there on 16th Street carrying a sign?
No, I had to get in the action. It was just one of those things you got to do when you work on K Street.
Yeah. Amber, you don't quite look like you're dressed for
a protest. I know. I had my long coat on. I think it was you that said we look like the 1%. Yeah. So I took that to heart and went, oh, better cover up here.
Yeah. I saw some guys. I didn't know who they were in our conference room in suits. And I thought, oh, are we harboring the 1%? Is this like a safe zone that we've advertised? This is, we all have ties on today because of our event. And I kind of wished I had my bike gear on instead.
Yeah, my sweatpants or something.
Mm-hmm. All right. So what you got for us this week?
All right. NAEP TUDA results. These are the reading and math results in fourth and eighth grade from 21 of the nation's large urban districts. It finds, like the overall national results, which were released about a month ago, that reading achievement is flat, mostly flat since 2009. Math, on the other hand, roughly half of the districts saw growth in the last 2 years. Charlotte-Mecklenburg was one of the headlines, the only district to see statistically significant reading gains since 2009, but only in eighth grade. Atlanta was the only district to make math gains at both grade levels since 2009, but that obviously raised some eyebrows given the city's recent cheating scandal, to which Commissioner Jack Buckley said that cheating on NAEP is virtually impossible given the security measures. On the bright side, most districts have witnessed gains in both subjects since the early 2000s, so if we look further back. And Mike Casterly was quick to point out, by the way, that the pace of improvement for large cities is outpacing the nation. For instance, eighth grade math scores in large cities rose 3 points from 2009 versus 1 point for the nation. Granted, this is not earth-shattering, but we'll take what we can get. Finally, a little bit of good news in Baltimore and D.C. Our neighbors, they inched up in fourth and eighth grade math scores. So, you know, we'll take what we can get. Detroit, by the way, inched up in math since 2009 by, I think, 8 points in eighth grade. But they're still have the lowest showing of all the 21 TUDA districts. And I did look at Cleveland. New Terry was here, and they are flat city since 2003.
So, first of all, I think I've seen a lot of the press on this already, and it's all focused on the difference from 2009 to 2011. Mm-hmm. And like, I just think that that's just too short a time, mm-hmm. right? I mean, we have data that goes back further. I mean, we should be talking about, you know, more. I mean, 2 years is just not a lot of time to change right. test scores, but 4 years or 6 years, I mean, then you can start to expect to see some real progress. And we do tend to see that in most
cities. Yeah, when you go back to the early 2000s, everybody's pretty much showing some gains, so. That's good news.
Yeah.
Are charter students a part of this, or are they outside of it? So it's just the kids who remain in a district?
I think it's public schools, right?
I think they're in there.
So charter kids would be in there, yeah.
Yeah, no, that, which is a great point, because in a place like D.C., we're talking about, you know, only 60% of these kids are DCPS kids.
Well, or Cleveland, it's, I don't remember, 35% are in charters.
Wow.
So it does make you wonder, are the charters having an impact here?
Right, right. And so that's both the question of, you know, the competitive, you know, are charters lifting all boats? I mean, you look in D.C., there's been very strong progress in D.C. And you say, is that Michelle Rhee's reforms? Is that because charter schools are performing better? Is that because the pressure from charter schools is pushing? It's hard to disentangle all of this.
Yeah, but instantly, that's where the biggest black-white score gap is in D.C.
Well, that's because the white kids that live in D.C. all have parents with PhDs.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. It's stark in D.C.
Right. I mean, there is no such thing as a working-class white population in D.C. Mm-hmm. You just can't find it. That's not necessarily the case still in some other cities. Mm-hmm. So, Terry, Cleveland. What's going on in Cleveland on life support, it looks like?
Well, I'm hopeful about Cleveland. I know that may sound odd, but there are things happening. You have a mayor who's truly engaged in these issues and has come out and taken some pretty tough positions when it comes to education. He supported many of the reforms when it came to the teacher issues that went down in Senate Bill 5, saying we need these flexibilities in Cleveland. They have been supportive of charters. They're supportive of really innovative district schools that are STEM-oriented and other sort of thematic schools. Are flexible. I mean, they have different contracts. They have waivers and these sorts of things, and they've shown results, at least on the state scores. This is what makes me a little nervous, is you see a lot of energy going into these school reform efforts, and then you look at TUDA and you say, wow, no impact, because Cleveland has, for the last decade, made a concerted effort. And you got some big funders up there, too, that have focused on this. So, I've not given up on Cleveland. I'm in Ohio, and I know LeBron James gave up on Cleveland. But you know, there is a lot of energy up there among the business community, among the mayor, among a lot of the foundations. They look at Detroit and they say, we don't want to be that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. Right. So this is great. You know, you may not have LeBron, folks, but you got Terry Ryan.
Right.
I love it.
There to stay.
So, The thing about NAEP is you never know what's you can't do causation, right?
That's
and
right.
So and you don't even know if it's really education policies that are driving any changes because there's also the demographic issue. And we do have cities where the demographics change pretty dramatically. I mean, D.C., again, there's been a ton of gentrification in D.C., so it's hard to know how that plays into these scores. And you could say a place like Cleveland, it's possible that they've continued to lose
poverty, middle class, working class families, all those things going on there. So one could say, hey, holding our ground isn't such a bad thing.
Right.
But the fact is, you realize the economic realities of this. And as the Common Core and these things are coming on, it's going to say, hey, we're going to raise the standard here. We're going to raise expectations. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, in Cleveland and in urban areas across the state of Ohio, and I guess across the country, they're having troubles meeting the standards we've currently given them. So it does raise the potential of a disconnect between greater expectations and their ability to get there.
All right, Amber, so what song goes along with this?
Well, since we're talking about cities, always tough to find a song here of late, but we've got Hot in the City by Billy Idol.
It's hot in the night, lonely black and white on a hot summer night. Don't be afraid of the world we may hate on a hot summer night. 'Cause when a lonely, lovely walks by, yeah, you can see her look in her eye.
What about you, Chris? Do you love Billy Idol?
You know, I can't say I'm a huge Billy Idol fan. But
a little too young for that.
A little before my time, but yeah. That's never stopped me from liking good music.
Oh, well, there you go. Good. It is. You're never too young to appreciate good music, huh?
That's right.
I woke up this morning and I got out of bed. Had a big old cup of coffee to clear my head. Telephone rang and you wanna chat? Well, sit on down and tell me what's up with that. What's up with that? Yes,
sir. Okay, all right. What you got for us this week, Chris?
Well, Christmas time will inevitably bring out the Scrooge that seems to exist in every office. You know who I'm talking about, that wet blanket colleague constantly saying things like, it's too early to celebrate the holidays. December is a working month. We certainly have one here at Fordham. But any office Scrooge would pale in comparison to one second grade teacher at George W. Miller Elementary School in Nanuet, New York. Even someone with a heart two sizes too small wouldn't stoop to this lady's level. When the North Pole came up, while the teacher and her 7 and 8-year-old students were participating in a geography lesson recently, she revealed to the students that Santa Claus doesn't exist and that their parents are the ones leaving the presents under the tree. What's up with that? What kind of human being, let alone teacher, has the humanity to ruin Christmas for a bunch of innocent second graders? Even if she was a child whose family didn't celebrate Christmas and thus didn't receive presents, forced to watch and envy as all of her friends got cool new toys every December, it doesn't excuse this behavior. The NEA and AFT claim they're on board with getting rid of the bad teachers. Well, let's start right here. I challenge anyone to defend such cold-hearted, child-hating behavior. Why is this woman a teacher in the first place? Unfortunately, we don't know for sure how the matter will be resolved, as school administrators insist it will be handled internally. I think the principal should mandate that both her students and her colleagues refer to her as Grinch or Mrs. Grinch for the remainder of the year. Or maybe leave some coal in her mailbox and a pink slip.
Wow, Chris, the passion for this one, I could tell this really got to you, didn't it?
You know, it was disheartening to read about this. I could only imagine having, you know, I'm not a father or anything like that, but having a cousin or a younger sibling or something and... you know,
did you have a painful experience when you found out that Santa Claus
wasn't? Exactly what I was thinking. Exactly where my mind went. This is personal.
How did that go down for you, Chris?
No, I have no scarring story to tell. Thankfully, you know, figured it out and, you know, deducted it naturally.
But here's what I want to know, Terry. In Ohio, where you guys are developing your new evaluation system for teachers, on what grounds would this teacher possibly be able to be terminated? I mean, it wouldn't show up in your value-added scores, but are there other parts of the evaluation where this kind of issue could get taken into consideration?
Well, one would hope that other teachers who go in and do the evaluation would be appalled by this behavior.
Well, if they happen to be in on the one day when she lets this out of the bag, I mean, come on.
Maybe student surveys. We are talking about having student surveys. I can see the second graders filing in their surveys that she bummed me out over Santa Claus.
Excellent. Okay. You heard it here first. One more compelling reason to include student surveys is to make sure we get teachers like this. And get them out of there.
Stop ruining the Christmas spirit.
Amen to that. Okay, that's all the time we got for this week. Until next week,
I'm Terry Ryan.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.